Mara Evering.
The previous program was Interpersonal Update with Dr. Harriet Fraud, and that's heard Wednesdays at 2:30 p.m. Stay tuned for Shawanana. That's coming up. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online.
This is the Shawanana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAIFM.
This is Zain Al-Amin with the Shawanana Show, and today's guest is Zaman Qureshi, and he's actually, Zaman is one of the best students I've had in my Arab World Studies class. And I had the pleasure of being audience to his presentation, which really turned my attention. I thought wherever Zaman works in the future, I gotta see what he's writing about. And recently he started working for the Citizens and the Real Facebook Oversight Board. As Zaman explained to me, that the Real Facebook Oversight Board name comes from the fact that there is an official oversight board, but apparently it's not doing as in-depth investigation as it should. And so that's the work. Welcome, Zaman.
Thank you, Professor. Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. I wanted to start with if you can tell the audience about, which is now in both D.C. and New York, about the Citizens and the Real Facebook Oversight Board. What exactly are you guys working on?
Sure. So the Citizens is the parent organization for the Real Facebook Oversight Board, based out of England. And the Citizens is essentially a group aiming to hold power to account, whether that's in the U.S. or the U.K., and in doing so has set up a number of projects that aim to hold feet to the fire, to hold power to account, and that is the sort of thought process behind the creation of the Real Facebook Oversight Board, which is the organization that I work for. The Real Facebook Oversight Board is a group of journalists, academics, researchers, and scholars who have come together to hold Facebook accountable in light of Facebook creating their own oversight board that has, as you said, Professor, really failed to take into account the necessary independence and transparency required to hold Facebook accountable.
And what are some of the main issues that you can talk about at this point that you're tackling now? What are you looking into when it comes to Facebook?
Yeah, so I specifically work on policy. And so I've had the privilege of working with a number of staff in Congress and members to break down some of these issues, specifically issues that we focused on now and in the past. I mean, the Real Facebook Oversight Board was largely formed as a response to the 2020 election. Many of our board members in Brains Trust felt that Facebook was not equipped to handle the 2020 election. And that really came full circle during the January 6th insurrection. So we've seen Facebook as a real accelerant of these challenging questions in our politics for a while now. And so we've mainly focused on how Facebook has influenced democracies. And while we focus specifically on the United States in 2020, we've broadened out to look at their impact in Brazil and that election coming up, or content moderation and content moderators in Kenya, for example, we have tried to focus on issues related to content moderation and climate denial, for example. And we really focused on trying to bring attention to the fact that this organization or this this committee that Facebook has set up, its own oversight board, really is powerless to address some of these major issues that need to be addressed if we're going to have safe social media in the 21st century.
Zaman, you have knowledge of you know, how these moneyed players like Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and so on, that have influenced, for example, on our, you know, on the news we receive, and also on about them using tools that are developed, for example, by the Israeli government to spy on, you know, on their enemies and such. How, in terms of, I know that Zuckerberg is had, you know, has met with all of those big shots like Mohammed bin Salman, and has sort of a close relationship with them, which I don't think has been affected by the Khashoggi murder. Can you talk about what you know about that?
Yeah, so I think, and based on what we've covered and seen, Mark Zuckerberg has tried to maintain a very close relationship with autocrats, dictators, and powerful rulers, because his platform and Facebook as a company, now called Meta, is really critical infrastructure in a lot of these countries. But he continues to monetize and profit off of these, the spread of disinformation or the rallying of people who are, for example, saying that an election is rigged. And in order for him to continue to keep making money off of some of these really, really dangerous movements that have started and festered on Facebook, he has to maintain this sort of close, tight-knit relationship with a lot of these world leaders. And one of those, while at least he was in the White House, was the former president, President Trump. And as you said, Mohammed bin Salman, and essentially trying to ensure that he has favorable ratings or favorable opinions from these autocrats around the world, because his service, the platform, the service that he offers, he makes a lot of money off of the content that gets put out, regardless of the country.
In terms of moving on to your article in Byline Times, first of all, tell us about Byline Times, Zaman.
Yes. So the Byline Times is a news organization for independent journalists, freelance journalists in the UK. Peter Jukes is the editor-in-chief there. Super grateful to Peter for sort of giving me my first start in the journalism and writing world. And Peter's sort of really been a good mentor in sort of crafting stories, where to look. A lot of the stories that I've done for Byline Times so far have not been sort of these blockbuster investigative reporting, but rather they've tied together these sort of what seem to be very separate, complicated issues together. So the first article that I wrote about was about Alexander Nix, the former CEO of Cambridge Analytica, and how he misled a House committee investigating Russian interference in the 2016 election. And so far, I've sort of moved around to address different issues related to interference in elections. And the article that you were referring to is an article I did about Thomas Barrack, who's a billionaire for a billionaire based out of California, who was a close friend of the former president, President Trump. And yeah, basically the article, which I'm sure we'll talk about, was done under Byline Times.
So, Thomas Barak, is this billionaire, has been accused of espionage. Is that true as a start? And tell us more about him.
Yeah, so Thomas Barak was indicted by the Justice Department. Basically, in this 46-page indictment, it lays out that Barak failed to register as a foreign agent, which is something that if you're dealing with foreign governments is necessary to do in this country. But as you said, he was also charged under the Espionage Act. And so the Foreign Agents Registration Act was the sort of FARA violation that he was required. But he was also charged under 18 USC Section 951 as acting as an agent of a foreign government. And so that was the same charge that was leveled against Maria Butina, the Russian spy who was charged by the Justice Department a few years ago. And basically in this indictment, it lays out how Barak, who is this wealthy billionaire from California, basically used his influence in the Trump campaign to buy the Emiratis a seat at the table. And Mohammed bin Zayed, the crown prince of the UAE, was very much interested in creating a relationship with the potential Trump government and the Trump administration, because he kind of fell out of favor with the Obama administration. Mohammed bin Zayed was not really interested in working with the Obama administration, basically because the Obama administration was not really interested in working with him. And so Mohammed bin Zayed went to sort of great lengths to come together with Trump officials. And Tom Barak was really that departure point, that key person in the Trump campaign at the time that was able to bridge that gap. And there have been a number of interviews before he was indicted that Tom Barak did, where he was lauding the Qataris, he was lauding the Emiratis, lauding the work that they had done in sort of strengthening the economy of their country and this great relationship that the Trump campaign and the Trump administration would maintain. He did that right up until almost a week before he was indicted. And it gets to sort of this other key issue about like what kind of potential interference did the Emiratis seek in the 2016 election?
Fascinating. And so tell us about Kushner's role in all of this.
Yeah, so Jared Kushner is the son-in-law of the former president. And Kushner was sort of appointed as this point person in the White House. He was this liaison to the UAE and Saudi Arabia. And his issues were mostly in the Middle East, the Arab world. And he was tasked with creating sort of better relationships with these countries. That all kind of went south during and after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post journalist. And the U.S. at the time, you know, the Senate Intelligence Committee, the CIA, all of the major intelligence organizations in this country, in the United States, agreed that Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, had ordered the murder of this journalist who was speaking out against Saudi Arabia. The one group or entity that failed to recognize this seemingly was the former president, was President Trump, who downplayed this murder and essentially tried to pass it off as rogue actors who committed this. So Jared Kushner was central in all that, in that he was sort of having to balance all of these sort of competing requests. But at the same time, Jared Kushner, even before he entered the White House and political life, had business dealings tied up with the Qataris. And he basically essentially had an investment in this really bad investment in this building called 666 Fifth Avenue in New York City, that it almost plunged his company into debt, and in stepped a very wealthy Qatari billionaire. His nickname is HBJ, Sheikh Hamad bin Jassim Al Thani. And he'd agreed to sort of bail out Kushner. And then at the very last minute, HBJ pulled out at the 11th hour. And basically, this is where sort of the gripe comes from Kushner. And there was sort of a fear amongst experts who knew Jared Kushner well, that he was sort of out to get the Qataris. And historically, the UAE and Qatar, sort of these billionaire powers in the Arab world, have been at odds with one another. And so he sort of used that as leverage to sort of play the Qataris and the Emiratis off of one another. And there is a Qatari source who told the Intercept that during the sort of crafting of the blockade into Qatar, that Jared Kushner essentially brought this gripe to full force, that he was pushing for this blockade in Qatar to try and essentially get back at the Qataris who failed to bail him out after making this really, really poor investment. The blockade ended after Trump left office in January, but this essentially was Jared Kushner leveraging his ties to essentially play politics in the White House. And as Middle East point person, he was sort of that balancing act.
In terms of Eric Prince, can you tell us about the role of Eric Prince?
Yeah, so Eric Prince is a really interesting character. He's sort of been everywhere. Eric Prince is the brother to former Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. And Eric Prince is sort of central in the intelligence inquiry into the 2016 election. So throughout my articles I've written about, I rely heavily on the bipartisan Senate Intelligence Committee's report into foreign influence in the 2016 election. And so the SSCI report relies chiefly on Russian interference, but there's sort of this undertone that got missed in a lot of the reporting as the Mueller investigation and the House and the Senate were investigating Russian interference. They were also investigating interference by the UAE. And little is known and little has been covered about the influence of the UAE, but essentially Eric Prince's role in all of this is that there was this sort of infamous meeting in the Seychelles in January of 2017. The Seychelles is kind of this this island nation off the coast of Africa, of Western Africa, Eastern Africa, and at this meeting, Eric Prince, Prince Mohammed bin Zayed, and this Russian individual Kirill Dmitriev met together, and it's not really discussed, or it's not really clear what was discussed at the time, but this was sort of seemingly agreed in the intelligence community. It's like, this was a meeting that took place that, you know, should be looked at because of the Russian interference that was looked at in the election. It sort of led investigators to probe why Prince Mohammed bin Zayed was also there, and look into interference by the UAE. Eric Prince subsequently was called to testify before the House Intelligence Committee. And Eric Prince is not only a very good friend of Donald Trump, but he's also a private military contractor. So he's sort of the head of this shadowy organization called Blackwater, which he sort of operates stealth under around the world to sell his services as private military. The most recent sort of headline that had Eric Prince in the news is that during the evacuation of Kabul and in Afghanistan, when the U.S. was pulling out, Eric Prince was essentially selling tickets to get people out of Afghanistan for exorbitant fees to get people out of the country. But he sort of specializes in these military defense contracts with foreign governments. And he did everything in his power to sort of hide the knowledge of this meeting. He came before the House Intelligence Committee and wasn't really forthright in what happened. He was actually referred to the Attorney General for perjury charges, because the House Intelligence Committee felt that he had misled the committee on a number of occasions. But chiefly this meeting in the Seychelles also comes back to Prince's dealings with the UAE in the past. He fulfilled a contract for Mohammed bin Zayed, where he formed a team of Colombian, South African, and mercenaries from elsewhere in the world to essentially round up political opposition in the UAE and get anyone who threatened Prince Mohammed bin Zayed's rule. And I think this just goes to show that MBZ, Mohammed bin Zayed, as a leader, as a ruler, sort of flies under the radar because so much focus in the Arab world is put on Mohammed bin Salman and the Saudis. But Mohammed bin Zayed is arguably just as influential. Maybe he doesn't have the economic leverage that the Saudis do, but he, you know, the UAE has a strong military sort of relationship with countries around the world. And Mohammed bin Zayed is a ruthless leader who has been in power for a while, and sort of, you know, rules, as we've seen, with some emotion. His relationship with the Obama administration and failing to kind of negotiate with the Obama administration and then using that to try and levy himself in the Trump administration, I think is kind of shows just what the lengths he's willing to go to get a seat at the table. But yeah, that was a long explanation, but that is sort of the role that Eric Prince has played and tied up in all of this.
That was a great explanation, and worthy of its length. You know, that's the common misconception. I agree with you. Mohammed bin Zayed is the greater evil. He has his hands in more countries, and he's always, you know, stretching out his influence left and right, more than Mohammed bin Salman. But it's Mohammed bin Salman that's focused on, and mainly because of the sensational, you know, slaughter that he's been involved in. Just a side note, I was very active in DC against the charter school movement, because I noticed that what was happening is that these millionaires that didn't even live in DC had their hands in the charter school movement and were funding it. And then it became like a Trojan horse for the privatization of public education. And at the same time, these were the same people that were also involved in the military industrial complex. And this is a story you might want to do later, Zaman. But at one point, the son, if you remember America Online, AOL, the son of AOL founder, I think his name was Mike Kimsey, was in an education forum that I was supposed to speak at. And it was just at the start of the second Gulf War, right? And it was also at a time when Blackwater was getting, finally was being exposed as killing civilians in Iraq, you know? So I got up to speak, and I was trying to make sure to figure out a way to tie both these moneyed interests that have one foot in our education system and one foot in the military industrial complex. When I got up, it got really easy, because when I looked at the front row, there was Mike Kimsey with a Blackwater t-shirt, and he was the leading charter school advocate. I said, I have exhibit A for what about to say, and I pointed to him and I said, this is the leading charter school advocate that's at every meeting, including, you know, school board meetings in Ward 8 here, I was trying to gather the two things, the military industrial complex and the privatization of our education. But there he is wearing a Blackwater t-shirt. There were people that were actually trying to stop me from exposing him because they felt that he might be able to fund our school system or something like that. Anyway, the point is that forum, he invited me for breakfast at Bus Boys and Poets down the street.
Oh my goodness.
To explain himself to me. And you know what he said, his explanation of wearing a Blackwater t-shirt, he says, I don't know really what Blackwater, you know, is doing, you know, and I know that they're getting a bad reputation, but my father went to Iraq, you know, this is the founder of AOL, for some mission there to help people. And he had hired Blackwater as a security detail. And when he came back, he brought me a t-shirt. You know, those t-shirts that say, my parents went to Iraq and all they got me was this t-shirt.
Right.
Explanation. I couldn't help from laughing.
Right. And also, yeah, of all the t-shirts you wear to a school board meeting, you wear a Blackwater t-shirt.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, these are spoiled rich kids that have no idea, can't read the room, basically. Right. This is a man who bought a fried chicken and watermelon to a Ward 8 school board meeting, and this brilliant man at the front of the room said, "Oh, we'd like to thank Mike Kimsey for the fried chicken that he brought," and he points to him. He knew exactly what's going to happen, and immediately teachers, they're so great, the teachers took their plates of fried chicken and dumped it in the trash because he pointed to this white millionaire standing in the corner smiling, not knowing what the cultural implication is. Anyway, this is what we're dealing with. Also, one thing, I don't know if you'll be able to comment on this, Zaman, for those of you who are just tuning in, I'm interviewing Zaman Qureshi, and he works at the Citizens and the Real Facebook Oversight Board. He's an investigative journalist. Give us the title of the Byline Times article, Zaman.
Yeah, so the title is U.S. Foreign Policy for Sale, Tom Barrack, Jared Kushner, and the UAE. And essentially, the article aims to sort of tie together all of these different actors and entities who actually acted a lot more closely together. Tom Barrack, this billionaire from California, Jared Kushner, the former President Trump's son-in-law, and Eric Prince, the head of this organization, a private military firm called Blackwater.
I wanted to ask you something that's sort of tangential, and I don't know if you'll be able to comment on it, but you knowing so much about the, or learning at least so much about what, you know, the power ploys by Saudi Arabia and the UAE. I recently read an article in the Middle East Eye that actually Putin's war now in the Ukraine is actually good news for Saudi Arabia and the UAE. What are your thoughts on that, if any?
I'm not sure. I missed. That's the first I've heard of it. But I think, you know, I think that just goes to show that whenever there's a conflict, military or cyber, these leaders in these countries are benefiting, and we can sort of use that point as a departure point to talk a little bit about NSO Group, this Israeli spyware firm that right. does have ties to the government, and how that has been used as a technology around the world within the past few years to target journalists and activists, and in doing so, like, the conflict benefits these leaders, and I think that's probably the sort of broadest point I can make about your question.
Mm. And tell us more about NSO. What does that stand for?
Sure. So NSO Group is essentially this spyware firm based out of Israel. It sort of came to light very much around the 2016 election, but more importantly, and more specifically, around the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, when it was discovered that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had bought this spyware called Pegasus 2.0, and not only infected the mobile phones of the fiance of Jamal Khashoggi, Khadija, but also the previous, at the time, the owner of the Washington Post, the publication which Jamal Khashoggi was a columnist at, Jeff Bezos. And so UN investigators basically found this spyware on Jeff Bezos's phone that was transmitting every single text message, phone call, image, picture. It could even enable the microphone and the camera on the phone while it was being used. And it was sending it back to the Saudis. And so essentially Mohammed bin Salman, in trying to petition Jeff Bezos, who was a good friend of bin Salman at the time, to, you know, sort of let this slide and not make this a big issue for the Washington Post, tried to remain a step ahead of him each and every time, and used what he was talking about as leverage against the former Amazon CEO and Washington Post owner. And so this software now has sort of come to light from that, because it's been used elsewhere. And this sort of tranche of reporting by the Investigative Bureau of International Journalism around the world, there have been stories done by The Guardian, The Washington Post, and all of these really reputable and coveted organizations that have covered the Pegasus Papers now, and have demonstrated how autocrats and really powerful leaders have bought this software to try and suppress dissidents, activists, and people who essentially threaten their rule or their reign. And, you know, I think it goes to show that any of us can be exploited. And while not everyone necessarily has to worry, because this is expensive software and it takes meticulous targeting to do so, but if you are sort of at the forefront or at the center of activism, of taking on power, you have to be really, really careful about what kind of messages you send on your phone, what kind of applications and software you use, and sort of, you know, where you're activating your device from, and what links you click on, because it was discovered that Jeff Bezos this software was able to be downloaded on his phone because a DHL tracking link was sent to his phone. And now NSO has developed their spyware further to essentially allow for the link or the software to be implemented onto a phone without having to be downloaded. And so a lot of the sort of discovery of this has come from the Dissident, which is this great film, this great documentary that I talked about in our class, Professor, that covers the murder of Jamal Khashoggi in really, really great detail. And so I think that the world is sort of left at a really crucial crossroads right now, where we have to sort of figure out this intersection, this development of technology and cybersecurity now being a threat to everyday people, and we are all sort of vulnerable in this fight, and we need to push our regulators and lawmakers to adopt safeguards that protect us from this kind of software, especially if we as individuals are doing work to try and hold power to account, because that power has greater resources and time available to do just that, to go buy the software and install it and listen to what you're saying.
That's really fascinating. I wanted to relay something to you about your you've graduated from AU now, right?
No, I'm a sophomore, so I
have 2 more years. That's amazing. You're going to do great things, buddy.
Thank you.
The one thing I wanted to tell you is that we recently at AU, we actually asked Muhammad Al-Kurd. Do you know who he is?
Yes.
Yeah, we're bringing him to AU, right? And about five departments and dozens of student organizations on campus co-sponsored the event. And then all the opposition from sort of Zionist elements on school and one school board member, not school board member, he's somebody that is part of the administration that has influence in the administration, I guess because of his contributions that he makes to the Israel Studies Department. Anyway, as expected, the pressure came on, and we had a venue and everything, and now I am told I wasn't involved in the organization. There were many students in many organizations and several professors that were involved in it. But now with this pressure, they're having to move the event to a supportive church in DC with Reverend Hagler, who's a known activist. And Reverend Hagler has welcomed that, and that'll be this Thursday at 7 p.m. But imagine somebody, this is, you know, Muhammad Al-Kurd, why is he scary to these people? Because him and his sister have been voted as the most, two of the top 100 or 200 most influential people of 2021. So this is like, he has been mainstreamed, and that scares them. And what he has to say, because he's so articulate about the cause, is tremendous. But I found it really interesting, and this is might be the topic that might have somebody has to tackle, if not the oversight board. But it reminds me of the common cuckoo bird, and the reason why I say that is because the common cuckoo bird, what they do is they lay eggs in other people's nests, and eventually the chicks that hatch for the common cuckoo will push out the host's eggs or the young out of the nest so that they don't have to share food. And I say that because when the Arab World Studies was founded or was started or was proposed at AU, then they said, where's the other voice? Meaning you have to have, if you have the voice of the oppressed and the occupied and et cetera, where's the voice of the oppressor? But anyway, that's, and so what was created is the Israel Studies Department at AU, and it's become like the common cuckoo. It's grown so large while this, you know, underfunded Arab World Studies department has remained as small as it is, and hopefully it'll grow in the future. But now it's pushing out the Arab World Studies, the other voices doing it. But I just wanted you to be aware that that's happening. But you can imagine how excited, I mean, Mohammed al-Kurd insisted on having this event as an intimate event. So we could have, as you probably could would guess, Zaman, if we had him in an auditorium, he would have filled it. You know, this is the kind of person, but it, rather he wanted to have an intimate meeting with AU students, which so we limited the room to 200 people initially when it was at AU. Only yesterday, 2 days before the event, I heard that they had to move it. But he wanted to have like 200 people, and around him, he wanted to have a circle so that it's not a lecture or a speech that he'll deliver, but rather a discussion that he'll have with the students. Anyway, it's been moved to Reverend Hagler's church, it's going to be an interesting event. I'm sure they'll pursue it, but it's hard to break through Reverend Hagler's fortifications. He's been in this fight for a long time.
It just goes to show that, like, the challenges of holding power to account.
Right, right. Well, Zaman, thank you so much for doing the work you're doing, which is holding power to account. And I'm sure we'll have you on with future projects that you can't talk about right now, but all very intriguing.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Take care.
You too.
And that was my interview with Zaman Qureshi about Facebook and Instagram and their censorship, and also the use of cyber tools that are being used by all the dictators that are supplied by Israel with this technology to spy on any political discontent. And if you want to know what is the result of that kind of spying, recently Saudi Arabia executed 81 political prisoners in one day. So for those of you shouting about Ukraine, and rightly so, I hope you're shouting about the even bigger massacres of civilians that are happening. Otherwise, you are a hypocrite and a racist. There's nothing beyond it. This is what I've learned from talking with Mohammed al-Kurd, the talk that I just mentioned. We're tired of humanizing the Arab people. If you are anti-Palestinian, if you're anti-Arab, you're a racist. It's simply that. And if you don't value the lives of Arabs, if you don't value the lives of Iraqis, if you don't value the lives of Afghanistanis like you're valuing now the lives of Ukrainian civilians that are being massacred, then you are a racist. So check in with yourself today, especially more than ever. Especially as the Democratic Party is doing a bang-up job of destroying the world as living up, living down its reputation as a lesser evil. It's becoming more and more as equal of an evil as any Trump that was put on the throne. Biden has betrayed every single promise. Recently, he's been doing that. He's been basically reverting to his self and all his promises from the campaign, whether it relates to affordable community college or higher education, whether it refers to healthcare, whether it refers to stopping the war in Yemen. He has reversed actually that kind of promise. He's gone the opposite way. So let's start with the fact that Biden is looking to spend $831 billion on the 2023 military budget. And this is at a time when there's 31 million Americans that have no health insurance. There's over 500,000, at least, that are homeless, that are counted. There are, we have, in terms of education, most postgraduate students are laden with around, at least on the average, $29,000 in debt. And nothing, he's doing nothing. He's feeding the bloated military. And America is sitting on its behind and not confronting this barbarity or this barbarous policy that he's following. When I talk about Yemen and Biden reversing, lying to us during the campaign. You know, a lot of you, I know you voted not out of love for him, but out of fear that you'll have another 4 years of Trump. But believe me, he's doing just as much damage. There's no question about it. 4 days ago was the 7th anniversary of the U.S.-Saudi war on Yemen. Now, if you look back at the speeches on the campaign trail for Biden, you will notice that he promised that to stop the war. He claimed that he would end this war. Instead, he is expanding it because the military-industrial complex is making loads of money of selling weapons to Saudi Arabia. And in the process, 400,000 have been killed in Yemen, right? And most liberals, let's talk frankly, most American liberals who are cursing Russia right now and sharing the pictures of dead civilians in the Ukraine, which should be shared, which should be shown, and which should be stopped, have never lifted a finger in all these years Yemenis are being killed. Are the planes, the Saudi planes that were bombing them, they were being fueled in the air by American planes. And in the process, 400,000, wrap this around your head, 400,000 civilians, Yemeni civilians, have been killed. 264,000 children have been killed. These are children under the age of five. And the starvation in Yemen as a result of this war, of this U.S. supported war, of this barbarity that America spreads everywhere, 17 million Yemenis that have been starved as a result of this war. So if you care about the deaths of civilians, don't just narrow it down to the blue-eyed, blonde-haired Ukrainians, which deserve all the love that you need. Expand it a little bit to people of color, which Biden, being the racist he is, has spent a whole career killing them and lynching them. It's funny, he recently signed the anti-lynching the legislation, but in reality, he is one of the architects of the crime bill, which has resulted in legal lynchings of thousands of African Americans in this country and people of color, and the wars he has supported and waged, and that he's feeding right now, and not taking any blame in how he has actually escalated the war on Ukraine. No responsibility is taken by Biden. No responsibility is taken by NATO and its expansionist policy. Not at all. It's all the blame is put on Russia, and Russia is not to blame, but not to be blamed alone. It has to be blamed equally with the U.S. and with NATO and with what they've done so far. And also to follow up on Zeman's report earlier, when he was talking about Facebook, Instagram, which along with Facebook have a history of censoring and silencing Palestinian stories, recently they removed the post relating to the Ibrahimi mosque massacre, where Israeli American settler by the name of Baruch Goldstein opened fire on Palestinians inside the mosque, killing 29 Palestinians and injuring 150 more. The Instagram removes it and says this is a violent post, right? But they haven't any barbarity committed around against Ukrainian civilians is not being removed as violence. So you could see the complicity of Zuckerberg with this. This is somebody that rubs elbows with all the dictators of the Arab world. And so he, and of course, he is very much a solid Zionist that supports the settler colonial project of Israel. And lastly, in terms of the news that I wanted to share was the issue that now you're getting reports probably, and these are not posts that are taken down, about Palestinians killing 11 Israeli settlers in the past week at in three different incidents. And of course, the story always starts with that. It doesn't start with the provocation by the Israeli government. It doesn't start with the demolition of 1,000 Palestinian homes. It doesn't start with settlers roaming the streets, beating Palestinians with the IDF in the periphery, waiting to help them in case they get in trouble. It doesn't start with settlers killing and burning trees, killing Palestinian farmers and burning trees. It doesn't start with this displacement with ethnic cleansing. It starts with the retaliation by Palestinians. That's where it starts. You know, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, in her very famous and viral TEDx talk on the danger of a single story, when she's talking about actually writing it, you know, a single story and how it relates to her background as a Nigerian. She quotes Palestinian poet Murid Barghouti, who writes, "If you want to dispossess a people, start the story with secondly." Again, if you want to dispossess people start with the story with secondly. And that's what they're starting the story with secondly. They're not starting with what is the reason for this retaliatory violent action, right? They're starting with secondly. And it's one of the most sobering things I've read about how the news is being reported in the United States about these things. And lastly, in this last minute, I just wanted to say that, you know, the death of Madeleine Albright in the last week has exposed her as a war criminal, in the sense that people are now posting what she said about the deaths of 500,000 Iraqi children, that it was worth it. And so I'm happy to see that truth come out, and I'm happy to see identity politics showing how impoverished it is. Thank you, and we will see you next Wednesday at the Shayunana Show. This is Zain Al-Amin signing off.
You believe in freedom, cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom,
tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI New York with a moment in women's history.
A choice as to whether or not we will rid the country of racism is a choice that white America has to make.
Ella Baker, co-founder of the Christian Leadership Conference to Fight Racism and the inspiring force behind SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, after the Greensboro, North Carolina lunch counter sit-ins. Along with CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, SNCC organized the 1961 Freedom Rides and in 64 Freedom Summer to register black voters in Mississippi. Baker says marches are necessary to dramatize injustice, but asks why march to Washington.
Why not march to Long Island? Why not march to Westchester? Why not march to the slums of New Jersey? Why not march to Harlem, to Bedford-Stuyvesant? Not in terms of a physical march, but in terms of recognizing that what is happening in these places in terms of poverty is a responsibility that has to be dealt with by those who are not impoverished. In other words, those of us who have money have got to speak to those who are in power.
Ella Baker says voting is the key. The Ella Baker Center for Human Rights Today advocates for books, not bars, jobs, not jails, health care, not handcuffs. You can hear more Ella Baker and other trailblazers from WBAI's Women's History Collection by becoming a WBAI buddy, a sustaining member of WBAI. $15 a month makes you a sustaining member, a WBAI buddy. You'll receive our extensive Women's History Collection, plus WBAI's tote bag, and we'll throw in a special gift. Please call 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950, to become a WBAI buddy in the name of your favorite WBAI program or in the name of all WBAI shows. 212-209-2950. We're looking for more people to become WBAI buddies. 212-209-2950. Or please go to this website, women.wbai.org, women.wbai.org, to become a WBAI buddy on this Women's History Day.
I'm a woman who speaks in a voice,
in a voice,
and I must be heard. At times I can be quite difficult. I'll bow to no man's word. Only we who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom
Hi, this is Bobby Humphrey. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
As we are in the final days of Women's History Month, we bring you a new Women's History exclusive. When Selma James founded the Wages for Housework campaign 50 years ago, it certainly had its